BBC World Service. Welcome to World Briefing with me, Catherine Mylor. The headlines at 9 o'clock GMT. The legal battle over the United States presidency has intensified, with a Republican candidate, George W. Bush, and his rival, Al Gore, engaged in separate challenges in the courts. Security has been stepped up in Israel following the car bomb explosion yesterday, in which at least two people were killed and many more injured. And there are signs of progress at the International Conference on Climate Change in The Hague on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. In other news, a new conference in Spain highlights the worldwide shame of violence against women. And a heap of old bones sheds surprising new light on the dinosaurs. This is the BBC in London. First, let's have our main stories in detail.
BBC News with Michael Poles. The legal fight over the result of the American presidential election has moved to the country's highest court. The Republican candidate, George W. Bush, has asked a federal Supreme Court to overturn a ruling from the top court in Florida that manual recounts by some counties in the state must be included. Meanwhile, officials in Florida are working through the national holiday of Thanksgiving to prepare the final tally in time for the deadline of Sunday night. However, faced with that deadline, officials in Dade County, in the Florida city of Miami, have abandoned the hand count, giving a crucial advantage to Mr. Bush. Our correspondent John Lyne is in Florida.
A handful of officials will continue processing ballots while America takes the day off. It's George W. Bush who will have more reason to enjoy his Thanksgiving turkey. The decision of Miami-Dade County in Florida to abandon its manual recount of the vote could hand the election to Mr. Bush. Counts are still going on in two neighbouring counties, but it's extremely difficult for Al Gore to make up the 930-vote deficit in the official tally. And most of the potential legal avenues for Mr. Gore have now closed. The next crucial deadline is Sunday evening, when the manual recounts have to be completed. Barring some final unforeseen twist, that is when Americans may finally know who will be their next president.
Israel is on alert for further violence following a car bombing in the northern city of Hadera, which left two dead and more than 60 others injured. The Israeli Security Cabinet began an emergency meeting. The Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, said he held the Palestinian Authority responsible for the explosion and is today meeting the victims' families. Palestinian officials said they were shocked by the accusation. Paul Wood has this report from Jerusalem.
The Palestinians say they expect a tough military response from Israel for the bus bombing after the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak said he blamed the Palestinian Authority. The United States has been trying once again to revive the negotiating process. The latest American plan put forward by the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, calls on the Palestinians to end the shootings, create buffer zones between protesters and the Israeli army, and arrest those responsible for bomb attacks. The Israelis are being asked to withdraw their forces, end economic sanctions against the Palestinians, and restrain their use of force.
The International Conference on Climate Change in The Hague is entering its closing phase, with signs of movement towards an agreement on how to enforce a worldwide reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. The Dutch chairman, Jan Pronk, said there had been moves towards a consensus, but if they failed, he might submit his own draft final resolution to galvanise the talks. The BBC correspondent at the conference says signs of a compromise emerged in overnight meetings, but no details are known as yet. One problem has been how to treat countries which plant new forests, such as the United States, but fail to reach their targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. You're listening to the news from the BBC. An international conference to oppose violence against women is taking place in the Spanish city of Valencia. The organisers say violence against women, whether it be at home, as a result of armed conflict, through female circumcision or the sex trade, is a huge worldwide problem. Flora Botswood reports from Valencia.
Among the delegates taking part will be Kim Phuc Van Thi from Vietnam, who as a girl was photographed naked fleeing a napalm attack by American forces. Safia Azim from Bangladesh, who campaigns on behalf of women who've had acid thrown in their faces by their husbands. Nahib Toubia of Sudan, whose organization opposes female circumcision. and Siripun Skrobanek, coordinator of the Global Alliance Against the Trafficking of Women. Just how much notice they managed to attract remains to be seen. The world is suffering compassion fatigue as it is, and women's interests are usually way down the list of priorities for any government. But the organisers say the discussions will help to analyse the different forms of violence that women are subjected to globally and to present some basic guidelines for continuing the fight against gender violence.
There's been an explosion in a car carrying three British nationals in Saudi Arabia. There's no indication as to who or what caused the blast in Riyadh. It's the second such explosion in less than a week. Last week, a British national was killed and his wife injured in what British officials said was a deliberate attack. Exchanges of artillery fire have resumed in Guinea-Bissau following an overnight lull between forces loyal to the president and the former military ruler. A BBC correspondent in the capital, Bissau, says gunfire could be heard from the main military barracks and the presidency. Our correspondent says there appears to be movement in the city but could not tell what it was. Bissau has been tense since Monday when the former military ruler, General Ansumane Mane, deposed the army chief and declared himself supreme commander in defiance of President Kumbayala. BBC News.
It's 09:06 GMT. You're listening to the BBC World Service with me, Catherine Myler. Tension remains high in Israel following yesterday's car bombing in the northern city of Hadera. Two people were killed and more than 60 others injured. The Israeli Security Cabinet has been holding an emergency meeting. The Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, said he held the Palestinian Authority responsible. Already today, there have been reports of fresh violence. Liam McSheffrey reports.
The Israeli government considers the situation so grave that a Security Cabinet intends to meet again this evening. Overnight, they held an emergency meeting following the bombing in the northern city of Hadera, which claimed two lives. The meeting came as the Israeli military reported of another explosion at a border crossing between Israel and the Gaza Strip. A Palestinian was reported killed. The Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Alan Pincus gave his government's reaction to the Hadera attack.
This has been a direct attack from the Palestinian Authority. Best of our information and best of our knowledge, the Palestinian Authority and its leader, Mr. Arafat, have given a green light to the radical elements within the Palestinian camp to go ahead and, in fact, given them had the green light to commit these acts of terror.
Palestinian officials said they were shocked by Israel's accusation. Hours before the car bomb exploded, Israeli troops in the Gaza Strip killed four Palestinians, including a leader of Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement, when they sprayed two cars with heavy machine gun fire. Marwan Kanafani is a spokesman for Yasser Arafat.
It has nothing to do with some skirmishes here or there. It's a planned attack against the Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority in order to make them accept what has been refused at the negotiating table. If this plan stops and the Israeli army withdraw, then I don't see any problem here.
Despite this, there may still be hopes for the stalled Middle East peace process. The Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami said the Americans had told him that the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat wanted to revive the peace process. Observers say this is a possible sign that Palestinians are seeking a way out of the current situation. Earlier, Israeli and Palestinian diplomats had angry exchanges at a formal meeting of the United Nations Security Council in New York. Each accused the other of being responsible for the latest upsurge in the violence.
That report by Liam McSheffrey. There's been an explosion in Saudi Arabia in a car carrying British nationals. It's the second such explosion in less than a week, as our Gulf correspondent Julia Wheeler reports from Dubai.
The Saudi authorities are taking what's being described as urgent action in investigating the explosion which happened in their capital, Riyadh, just after midnight local time. They've cordoned off the area and restricted access to where the blast happened, on the outskirts of the upmarket district of Sulaymaniyya, near the centre of the city. Diplomats at the British Embassy in Riyadh say they're working with the Saudi authorities, but that the possibility of British investigators being involved in the inquiry hasn't been ruled out. The three Britons are not suffering from life-threatening injuries. The Saudi authorities are believed to be looking into the possibility of a link between this explosion and a blast last Friday in which a British man was killed and his wife injured.
That was Julia Wheeler in Dubai. The last elected Prime Minister of Sudan, Sadiq al-Mahdi, is expected to return to Khartoum today after 4 years in exile. Mr. al-Mahdi was overthrown by the current president, General Omar al-Bashir, in 1989. He says he's returning to reactivate his Umar party, which is the largest in Sudan. He's expected to get a huge welcome, as Caroline Hawley reports from Cairo.
The last Sadiq al-Mahdi saw of Sudan was the border crossing to Eritrea, which he fled through in 1996, dressed, legend has it, as a woman. He'd spent much of the previous 7 years either in prison or under house arrest. Now he's flying back to Khartoum with the approval of the man who overthrew him, President Omar al-Bashir. Until last year, Mr. al-Mahdi's Umma party was part of the NDA, a coalition of northern and southern rebel groups trying to overthrow General Bashir. But last year, the Umma broke ranks with the NDA and began a process of reconciliation with the government. That's already led to the return of dozens of Umma party activists and hundreds of former fighters. Now it's the turn of Sadiq al-Mahdi himself. The former Prime Minister argues that as Khartoum has tried to patch up its ties with its neighbours, there's now less scope for opposition activity abroad, coupled with a slightly greater margin of freedom at home. He says he wants to reactivate the Umma party and work for political pluralism in Sudan. But many in the Sudanese opposition believe his return is premature and is motivated largely by personal interests.
Caroline Hawley, reporting there from Cairo. The International Conference on Climate Change in The Hague is entering its closing phase, with ministers making their final attempt to reach a consensus on how best to enforce a worldwide reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Although there are signs that an agreement may be reached, there have been complaints from many in the developing world that the conference has failed to address their concerns. Douglas Brown, who works for Friends of the Earth in Ghana, has been in The Hague for the past week.
We are not too pleased with sort of proposals that have been put forward by the industrialized countries. It seems they are trying to renegotiate the convention through the back door. The fact that industrialized countries have not done their part of the bargain, they have not undertaken their commitments under the convention, and yet they have come forward with new proposals to renegotiate, as it were, those same provisions under the convention. They are using their power, their might, their clout, their money, their resources, everything to steer the negotiations in their favour, in their way. And I think that it is rather unfortunate.
Douglas Brown from Friends of the Earth. The meetings have been continuing through the night to try to settle complex arguments over the rules on achieving targets to cut greenhouse gas emissions. The Dutch chairman, Jan Pronk, said that an agreement was in sight. But if they failed, he might submit his own draft final resolution to galvanise the talks. Tim Hirsch is at the conference.
After a week and a half in which the talks seemed deadlocked, the first signs have emerged overnight that compromises are getting closer. Ministers worked into the early hours to try to settle a series of complex arguments about how the system of cutting greenhouse gas emissions should work. A key breakthrough seems to be that more money is on the table from industrialized countries to help the developing world to cope with the impact of climate change and to use cleaner technology. A clearer picture should emerge later this morning when ministers report back to the conference president, but he's said to be surprised at the amount of progress which has been made.
Tim Hirsch in The Hague. There's been more shooting in the capital of the West African state of Guinea-Bissau, where a power struggle is continuing between the president and the former military leader. The immediate cause of the dispute is disagreement over nominations to the Army Officer Corps between the elected president, Kumba Yala, and the influential army chief who led a military rebellion in 1988, Ansumane Mane. Our West Africa correspondent, Mark Doyle, reports from Abidjan.
Sources in the centre of the city of Bissau said gunfire was heard shortly after dawn, but that the situation then appeared to have calmed down. The power struggle between the elected president and the influential military figure General Ansumane Mane is similar to that which broke out 2 years ago between forces loyal to Mane and another head of state whom he succeeded in overthrowing. This time round, the United Nations Security Council has warned Mane that he will be held responsible if the fighting escalates into full-scale war, as it did in 1998. That hasn't happened yet, but already some residents of the capital have been seen packing their bags, ready to flee if necessary. The army plays an important role in Guinea-Bissau, a former Portuguese colony, partly because of the legacy of an anti-colonial struggle, which gave independence veterans positions of considerable power.
Our West Africa correspondent, Mark Doyle. The party of the former presidential candidate Alassane Ouattara in Ivory Coast has welcomed a decision by the Electoral Commission to allow him to stand for parliamentary elections. A party spokesman, Ali Koulibaly, said the decision proved the commission was independent. Mr. Ouattara was barred by the Supreme Court from standing for president because they said he was not Ivorian. A former interior minister, Emile Constant-Bombé, was also banned, but he's now been told that he's eligible to take part in the parliamentary elections. The dispute over Mr. Ouattara's candidacy led to violence between his supporters and that of the newly elected president, Laurent Gbagbo. A prominent Mozambican journalist has been shot dead in the capital, Maputo, in what police say may have been a carefully orchestrated assassination. Police say Carlos Cardoso, the editor of the influential news sheet Metical, was shot down in a hail of automatic gunfire outside his offices in Maputo on Wednesday evening. Mr. Cardoso had a reputation for independence and was fiercely critical of both the governing Frelimo party and the opposition Renamo party. Greg Barrow reports from Johannesburg.
Mozambican police say Carlos Cardoso was shot dead by a group of men who fired automatic weapons from at least two cars as he was leaving his offices on Wednesday night. They say he was killed instantly. Mr. Cardoso was probably the most prominent independent journalist in Mozambique's modern history. He was a white Mozambican of Portuguese descent who stayed in the country after its independence from Portugal in 1975. Although he worked under a Frelimo government during Mozambique's devastating civil war, he always strived to maintain his independence, and it may have been this that brought him enemies in the era of peace since the end of the civil war in 1992. The Mozambican government has said it is deeply shocked by Mr. Cardoso's death. An opposition Renamo spokesman has also mourned the murder of Mr. Cardoso, saying Mozambique has lost one of its most courageous and critical voices. The shooting comes at a time of heightened political tension in Mozambique, with Renamo making veiled threats about returning the country to civil war. All sides are calling for a swift investigation to identify the perpetrators of this crime and end speculation about potential political motives for Mr. Cardoso's murder.
Greg Barrow sent us that report from Johannesburg. You're listening to the BBC in London, and today's main news is that the legal battle over the United States presidency has intensified, with the Republican candidate George W. Bush and his rival Al Gore engaged in separate challenges in the courts. Security has been stepped up in Israel following the car bomb explosion yesterday, which killed at least two people and injured many more. And there are signs of progress at the International Conference on Climate Change in The Hague on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Police in Thailand have opened fire on a group of escaping prisoners who'd taken prison officials hostage. Reports say all nine prisoners were killed. Their three hostages were released, though all were wounded and one is in a coma. The shooting took place almost a day after the inmates broke out of a jail near Bangkok in a truck they'd commandeered. As they tried to reach the Burmese border, they released four hostages. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Simon Ingram reports from Bangkok.
The hostage drama ended in dramatic and violent fashion early this morning. By that time, the group of armed convicts who'd seized three hostages during a prison breakout on Thursday were close to reaching their objective, the border with neighbouring Burma. When the pickup truck carrying the group suffered a puncture, the security forces made their move. Television pictures from the scene showed up to a minute of intense gunfire around the parked vehicle before masked commandos with automatic weapons moved in, apparently to finish off the convicts who were not already dead. Their bodies were later seen lying on the road. The hostages, who included the prison governor, are all reported injured. One hostage was seen being taken away by stretcher, his hands still cuffed. The hostage takers were Burmese nationals, facing trial for drug trafficking, murder and other offences. An inquiry has been launched into how they managed to obtain the pistols and hand grenades they used to make their escape from the prison in Samut Sakhon province, southwest of Bangkok. One man, a prison religious instructor, was shot dead in the early stages of the breakout.
That was Simon Ingram reporting there from Bangkok. Southeast Asian leaders are meeting later today in Singapore to discuss ways of achieving closer economic integration. Heads of state and government from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations will also be discussing how close they want their relations to be with neighbouring countries outside their group. Leaders from South Korea, China and Japan will join the talks. Ahead of the meeting, ministers have agreed to allow some countries to opt out of dropping particular tariff barriers. The agreement follows a request from Malaysia to be able to protect its car industry. Heavy monsoon rains in Malaysia have killed 7 people and forced more than 4,500 others to leave their homes. The hardest hit areas are in the northeastern states of Terengganu and Kelantan, where communications, power supplies and rail and road links have been disrupted. There's also been severe flooding in the southern Thai city of Hat Yai. After weeks of political uncertainty in Peru, things are now beginning to look a little clearer. After being caught up in a bribery scandal involving his former security chief, Alberto Fujimori offered to resign as president. And now an interim president, Valentin Paniagua, has been sworn in. In a surprise move, Mr. Paniagua announced that the former UN Secretary General, Javier Pérez de Cuellar, would be prime minister. Claire Marshall reports from Lima.
Yo, Valentin Paniagua Corazao, juro por Dios.
The words of the presidential oath of office being said by Valentin Paniagua in the chamber of the Peruvian Congress, finally bringing to an end a decade of rule by Alberto Fujimori. With the disgraced ex-leader still in Japan, Mr. Paniagua now has the role of leading Peru for the next 8 months to new elections and to the installation of a new president next July. The mood of the members of Congress who had voted to sack Alberto Fujimori for moral unfitness was jubilant. Ombudsman Jorge Santisteban said this was a historic day.
With this new president, we are starting the transition, which is going to head us to new elections. And with that, we are going to recuperate democracy for this country.
Congress member Anel Townsend said she had faith that Mr. Paniagua will improve democracy in the country.
So you think Valentin Paniagua is the right man to lead Peru through this next stage?
I think that that is true, because he was elected not only by opposition groups, but also by ex-members of the governmental parliamentary group. It shows that he comes from a combination of wishes for democracy.
Mr. Paniagua's election as interim president also had the strong support of U.S. Ambassador John Hamilton.
It's going to be a wide-open election. It's going to be a fascinating process. I think democracy is going to be strengthened here, and because of that, the relationship with my government will be strengthened as well.
However, there is still a deep anger over the way in which Alberto Fujimori, who had led Peru for 10 years, abandoned the country at such a critical time, with no prospect of returning. Tara Martinez, aged 28, who had come to the Congress to catch a glimpse of the new president, was deeply shocked.
I feel so confused, because I really trust in my president Fujimori, but at this moment I don't know what to do, how to sing, because he is lost now.
Congress member Luis Celeri echoed her thoughts.
How about the manner in which President Fujimori resigned?
Oh, that was a shame for our country. And it was a shame for every people who has felt that has been abandoned by him.
However, with a respected figure with widespread support now in charge of the country, there is a strong sense of optimism that an end to the instability, which has been so damaging to Peru, is at last within reach.
Claire Marshall reporting from Peru. Suspected paramilitary gunmen in Colombia have killed 17 people in an attack on a small village on the northern coast. Witnesses said the victims were taken from their homes and shot one by one. Police said they'd been singled out for their alleged support of left-wing guerrillas who are active in the area. Human rights groups blame paramilitaries for most of the attacks on civilians in Colombia's internal conflict, which has claimed the lives of an estimated 35,000 people in the last decade. Trade unions in Argentina plan a strike on Thursday against economic problems and the policies of the government of President Fernando de la Rúa. The president has announced tough measures to contain public spending in an effort to strengthen the government's finances and secure new loans from the International Monetary Fund. Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker reports.
The financial markets have been getting very uneasy about Argentina. There are concerns that it might have difficulty making the debt repayments that will be due next year. In the last week, both the leading international credit rating agencies, which advise financiers on how risky borrowers are, have voiced concerns about Argentina. And the markets have become more nervous about developing countries in general, a concern shown in rising interest rates on these countries' debts. The IMF is also concerned and has been negotiating additional loans to help Argentina avoid default. An IMF official said a team is expected to start further talks in Buenos Aires on Monday. Argentina is one country that is still suffering the effects of the wave of developing country crises that began in Asia in 1997. In January 1999, the problem was compounded when Brazil devalued its currency, leaving Argentina nursing a sudden decline in its competitiveness. The peso is rigidly linked to the US dollar. That year, the country went into recession. The government's finances suffered from the lower tax receipts that always result from weaker economic performance. President de la Rúa plans to reform pensions and has made a spending control agreement with the provincial governors. These measures are intended to strengthen the public finances and improve the confidence of foreign investors and lenders. They were also needed for agreement with the IMF. But such policies are nearly always unpopular. They and the underlying economic problems are the background to the planned strike.
Our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. Scientists say two collections of dinosaur fossils found in North and South America suggest that larger carnivorous dinosaurs, like the Tyrannosaurus or T-Rex, hunted in packs rather than individually, as previously thought. The new theory emerged after bones were found in South America from what could be the largest carnivore ever to have walked the Earth. Toby Murcutt of our science unit reports.
Only a handful of T-Rex skeletons have ever been found, and all were unearthed in isolation. As a result, paleontologists believe that these enormous meat-eating dinosaurs were solitary hunters. Nevertheless, carnivorous dinosaur expert Phil Curry believed that some of these animals were pack hunters, allowing them to tackle large prey. But there was no proof of this. Now, though, two separate finds in North and South America suggest these beasts did indeed hunt together. Phil Curry himself rediscovered a long-lost site in Canada containing the remains of at least 14 albertosaurs, a smaller cousin of T-Rex. And in Patagonia in South America, dinosaur hunter Rodolfo Correa found a group of around six similar very large meat-eaters. Phil Curry believes that these are the remains of packs of animals which died together in some form of natural disaster, such as a flood.
Toby Murcutt of our science unit. A reminder of today's main world news now. The legal fight over the result of the American presidential election has moved to the country's highest court. The Republican candidate, George W. Bush, has asked the Supreme Court to overturn a ruling from the Florida State Supreme Court that manual vote recounts by some counties must be included in the final tally. You're listening to the BBC in London.